get your kicks on Route 66. It winds from Chicago to LA. It's more than 2,000 miles on the way. Say you get your kicks on Route 6.
Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen, and today I'm joined by CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer, Jesse Bell. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter, Christina Laurie, covering a groundbreaking study being conducted by researchers at the Kingston Health Sciences Center Research Institute.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca.
For the first time ever, researchers are studying whether non-hallucinogenic doses of psilocybin, the active compound found in psychedelic mushrooms, could help to treat generalized anxiety disorder. The Kingston Health Sciences Center Research Institute is leading this first-of-its-kind Health Canada-approved Phase 2A clinical trial. The trial will be testing the daily, at-home use of microdose psilocybin to see if it can safely ease anxiety symptoms without the trip. Generalized anxiety disorder affects about 5% of Canadian adults, more than 1.6 million people. And while it's common, many existing treatments can be slow to work or cause side effects that make long-term use difficult. Principal investigator of the study, Dr. Claudio Suarez, sat down with CFRC to tell us more about this first-of-its-kind clinical trial and what it could mean for the future of anxiety treatment. To start us off, I was wondering if you'd like to just introduce yourself for our listeners.
Well, my name is Claudio Suarez. I'm a psychiatrist here at Queen's University. I'm professor of psychiatry at Queen's. I'm also a clinician who sees patients in the medical and surgical floors from psychiatry. I work also in oncology and palliative care. And I do research. I'm the director of the Center for Psychedelics Health and Research at Providence Care, and also doing research on psychedelics here at KGH.
Great. Thank you. And getting into our topic today, I was wondering if you could start us off by speaking to the gaps and challenges in current treatments that have kind of led to us turning to exploring these alternative methods.
For sure. So as you know, we have a lot of people suffering from depression and anxiety, like more kind of a clinical disabling anxiety, like 1 out of 6 Canadians have anxiety. And not everybody do well, not everyone does well on medications, right? So we have psychotherapies that are quite effective for anxiety. But again, not everybody has access to psychotherapy and not everybody responded to psychotherapy. And the medications that we have are primarily antidepressants that we use for anxiety. Some patients responded well, but they can't tolerate side effects. They have, you know, weight gain or sexual dysfunction. So we're always looking for new treatments for anxiety to have another tool in our toolbox. And psychedelics are emerging as kind of promising treatments for anxiety. So that's why one of the things we're looking for is the use of a low dose or microdosing psychedelics, in this case, psilocybin for anxiety.
Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could speak a bit to the background and evidence so far, just where we're at with psilocybin specifically.
Sure. So psilocybin is the active ingredient of the magic mushrooms, right? So they have been used in like recreationally, but also in ritual and religious ceremonies for many, many, many years. And probably over the last 10 or 15 years, we're kind of experiencing like a renaissance in research on psychedelics. People are rediscovering psychedelics as potential medical treatments and trying to apply what we know about psychedelics for many years into the medical setting. So we see a lot of studies happening in psychedelics, particularly psilocybin, for depression, anxiety, to reduce cravings for alcohol in patients who have alcohol use disorder, and for PTSD as well. Although PTSD is more MDMA, that has been studied for that. But the psychedelics, Christina, in most studies, the predominant school of thoughts for psychedelics is to use what we call macrodoses, right? So people have a dose that induces changes in their perception of the environment, and perception of themselves. That's what we call the altered states of consciousness, or the trip. It's like people go through a hallucinogenic trip, which is it's an epiphenomenal. So there's a lot of things happening in your brain at the time that you do that. But that requires patients to come to a medical setting and use that medication and be under observation for at least 6 to 8 hours. So it's labor intensive. There are some more risks and side effects involved. The more recent school of thoughts were in parallel to that, we're looking at using psilocybins in lower doses that will not cause that whole experience of psychedelics from the hallucinogenic point of view, but will still have beneficial effects in your brain, maybe increasing neuroplasticity, maybe helping you to reduce the ruminative thoughts or the, you know, constant worrying that you have and anxiety. And they seem to work well. So there are some promising studies, but they have not been tested in a more kind of a, I would say, structural way. So that's the first study that we are aware of that's using microdosing delivered at home to be used at home for anxiety.
Mm-hmm. And again, you're talking about microdosing there and kind of getting into the nitty gritty. I was wondering if you could dive a bit deeper into what this means, either in practical or neurological terms, sure. As opposed to, you know, going on a full macrodose and having those experiences.
For sure. So when we talk about macrodose or higher doses of psilocybins, usually we're talking about taking at least 25 or 30 milligrams of psilocybin, which then will induce that altered states of consciousness or, you know, what recreationally people call a trip, right? And that is probably the way or the mechanism by which psilocybin works in macrodoses. So it's a boost of effects at once that cause a cascade of reactions in your brain, increase neuroplasticity, and then opens that what we call more flexibility in your cognition to deal with anxiety. And that is done in combination with psychotherapy. So the notion is that you're using the macrodose to make it easier for patients to engage in psychotherapy and make it easier for them to be more cognitively flexible, to be more psychologically open to psychotherapy. When we're using microdosing, you're usually using a much lower dose, so it's between 1 to 3 milligrams. The sweet spot that we're trying to study is around 3 milligrams because it's just below the threshold for changing your brain from the hallucinogenic point of view. So at that dose, you're using the pharmacological effects of the psilocybin. So you're not inducing the hallucinogenic trips. You're not inducing changes in your perception. It's almost like using the same pathway that we use in antidepressants, but without having the side effects of the antidepressants. So the idea here is to use psilocybin more as a medicine as opposed to a catalyst for psychotherapy.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Because I think a lot of people, I think about psychedelic treatment as the experience of the trip is more so what's solving your issues or helping you work through it. But this sounds like it's more like those chemical changes in your brain, and that it's a bit different. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So, and that's, you know, what you mentioned before, the psychedelic experience make it easier for you to do psychotherapy. This is probably the predominant classic way of thinking about psychedelics. And probably, I want to say 80 to 90% of the research on psychedelics so far has been focused on that way of delivering psychedelics. But we also know that psychedelics are neuroplastogens. So they change the brain plasticity, and they also have effects through serotonin in your brain, the same chemical that we use in antidepressants. So it's interacting with the same receptors that we use in medications, for instance, for depression and anxiety. So what we're looking at here is to benefit from, you know, slow doses or low dose of psilocybin delivered every day for a period of time, similar to what we do with other medications, but hopefully have a more enduring and less troubled from the side effect point of view that we have with antidepressants. So minimizing sexual dysfunction or weight gain or all the other side effects that sometimes are a major barrier for people to take medication for anxiety.
Mm-hmm. And getting into this clinical trial, what's that going to kind of look like and what makes it such a first in Canada?
So this is the first time that we're aware of that Health Canada has approved a study to allow us to give patients microdosing psilocybin to bring it home and take it home. So as you know, psilocybin is illegal, so you cannot or you should not go and buy psilocybin anywhere. So in order for you to do studies on psilocybin, we have to apply to a lot of regulatory bodies, including Health Canada, to get permission to obtain the psilocybin and store the psilocybin. So that has been done for other studies as well. But this study in particular allow us to then have a protocol in which patients come and try psilocybin for the first time in our hospital. They stay here for a few hours. We make sure that they don't have any unusual responses to psilocybin. And then they can take the medication at home. So they go home with a 1 week's worth of medication, and then they can use the medication at home. We monitor that very closely. And then they come every week to be reassessed up to 4 weeks. So it's a 4 week trial. And then people who responded well can stay for another 4 weeks when we then randomize them to be either on placebo or to remain on psilocybin. So that we're going to be looking at if they have any withdrawal symptoms or rebound anxiety after using for 4 weeks. So the total study is 8 weeks, but the first 4 weeks, everybody knows you're taking medication. And then the next 4 weeks, we split them between placebo and medication.
Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, what kind of outcomes are you measuring?
Yeah, so this is a phase two trial. So the clinical trials have different phases. So phase one usually is what we're looking at if the new medication is toxic or trying to find the right spot, so to speak, on the dosing. So that's how we end up with a 3 milligram dosing for this study. So this is a phase two trial. Phase two trials are usually small trials, like less than 100 patients. What we're trying to look at primarily safety and tolerability. So we're looking at if patients have any side effects. We check their blood work to see if their, you know, kidneys are working well, their liver, their heart, to make sure that everything is okay prior to, but also make sure the medication doesn't impact their health in general. But we also collect some data on efficacy. So we look at scales for anxiety, measure their anxiety, their self-perception of anxiety, how well they're functioning at home or work or at school. So there are a few measures that we use to look at success. And that study will inform, hopefully, a phase three trials. For phase three are larger trials, more like what we see when we're applying for new medications to Health Canada or FDA. We have to use a phase three trial. So these are larger trials. But this trial that we're doing, we will inform the next one if everything goes well.
Mm-hmm. And I was just going to ask you, just as a clinician and as a scientist, what excites you about diving into this research?
Well, so when I got involved with psychedelic research probably close to 3 or 4 years ago, when Queen's decided to put together a advisory board to look at psychedelic medicine. And I came from the field on psychiatry, mood disorders, but also see patients in oncology. So I was aware of the major gaps that we have in the treatments that we have for depression, anxiety, but also PTSD and oncology. A lot of patients with late stage cancer have what we call existential distress, and that really doesn't respond well to medication. And psychedelics have emerged in the last few years as a promising option for many of those patients. But there are not a lot of clinical trials happening in Canada. And I became fascinated with some of the options. And I saw and I've seen, I did a long training in US, close to 1 year on psychedelic research. And I've seen both patients and participants, but also videos with dramatic changes very quickly. So I became quite fascinated by the promising effects, but also very aware that psychedelic research comes with a lot of stigma, a lot of mistrust and misinformation. So getting involved in research, but also helping to destigmatize psychedelics and find the right population that can use, it became one of the areas that I'm quite interested in. So we created a Center for Psychedelics at Providence Care. We opened last year, and we're doing research both at Providence Care, but also at KGH as well.
Mm-hmm. And what are you hoping this means for the future of care in this area?
So I think if we can learn when and how psychedelics can be helpful, that will inform probably in a better way how can we use psychedelics in the medical setting versus recreational, which is one of the challenges with cannabis, for instance. Right? When cannabis became legalized, the research on cannabis suffered because a lot of the medical cannabis research became very difficult to conduct studies because people just go across the street and buy what they think they're buying, right, in terms of concentration and use. So what we're trying to do is to avoid that we make some of the mistakes that we made with cannabis in general, that we understand how psychedelics can be used safely for medical purpose. So then if or when psychedelics become legalized, we can clearly differentiate what is psychedelic use for medical practice versus psychedelics for recreation.
Mm-hmm. And just to wrap us up here, who can take part in this study and how can people get involved or learn more?
Yeah, so people can reach out to us. So they can look at, you know, CS Research at queensu.ca, but they can also reach out to KGHC or the Center for Psychedelics at Providence Care. What we're looking for this particular study are anyone ages 18 to 60. Whose primary diagnosis is anxiety. Either they were diagnosed with anxiety by their GP or their primary care or psychiatrist, or they were medicated for anxiety in the past. And they're having right now anxiety that's really affecting their ability to function, like constant worries or concerns, inability to function due to anxiety. They cannot be suffering from major depression or psychosis or alcohol use disorder. But we will screen them. We will have an assessment. And if they qualify, they can come to the study. We do a series of medical assessments to make sure they are healthy otherwise. And then they can join the study.
Once again, that was Dr. Claudio Suarez, who will be leading a first-of-its-kind study on the use of psychedelics to treat generalized anxiety disorder at the Kingston Health Sciences Center Research Institute. As one of the largest mental health research trials currently underway at KHSC, the study represents an important step in advancing evidence-based innovation in psychiatric care. As Dr. Suarez mentioned, researchers are currently seeking adults living with generalized anxiety disorder to join the study. To learn more or inquire about participation, you can contact the research team by email at cs.research@queensu.ca. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
Thank you, Chris. Next is Dinah Jansen with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for YGK News, Owen Fullerton, that highlights the outstanding achievements of two local folk musicians.
Thank you, Jesse. Two Kingston artists have returned to the city as award winners following last week's presentation of the 2025 Ontario Folk Music Awards in Ottawa. Kingston's Al Rankin was awarded the Estelle Klein Lifetime Achievement Award for what Folk Canada said is the lifelong dedication to fostering Canadian folk music, and Savannah Shea was awarded Song of the Year for her song Best Remembered. Rankin's longtime work as a concert promoter has earned him the Estelle Klein Lifetime Achievement Award, which Folk Canada's Executive Director Rosalind Dennett says a long list of artists have said his support goes beyond simply putting on a show. While Rankin is being recognized for his longtime work with the music industry, Savannah Shea represents the current generation of working artists and said that this year was her first experience with the Folk Music Awards, and one she wouldn't have been a part of if not urged to apply by the city's music officer, Moira DeMore. Shea said it wasn't in her plans before that, but she was happy to be there taking advantage of what the conference had to offer and meeting other musicians on hand. I don't think I would have gone if I hadn't got the nomination because it just wasn't on my radar, Shea said. 2025 is the 39th anniversary of the Folk Music Ontario Conference, with Folk Music Canada and Folk Music Ontario merging officially this year. The awards were focused just on Ontario folk music creators and industry members, but Folk Music Canada also brought in people across the country to take part in the conference. difference. Dennett said the hope of these awards is to get more attention on hardworking songwriters and workers in the music industry, and ultimately to help make the industry a more viable place to work in. "We want to grow a working middle class of artists and music industry professionals," Dennett said. And thank you to Owen Fullerton for that story. Now over to Jesse Bell with a story from the LJR reporter for the Kingstonist, Michelle Dory Forsdell, with a story covering Greater Napanee's purchase of a $2 million fire truck.
Thank you, Dinah. Greater Napanee's Fire Department will replace its 22-year-old aerial ladder truck after council approved a $2 million purchase, citing reliability issues, rising maintenance costs, and outdated safety features. In a report presented at the regular meeting of the Council of the Town of Greater Napanee on Tuesday, October 14th, Fire Chief Sean Armstrong recommended the non-competitive purchase of a 103-foot KME-branded aerial ladder apparatus from Dependable Emergency Vehicles out of Brampton, with delivery expected in January 2026. After discussing the feasibility and timing, council agreed the purchase was necessary and financially advantageous. According to Armstrong, the town's current aerial truck, known as Ladder 811, has been in service well beyond its recommended 15-year frontline and 5-year reserve lifespan. Industry standards no longer recognize aerials older than 20 years, which can affect the municipality's fire protection ratings and, in turn, its emergency response and insurance. The aging vehicle has also become increasingly expensive to maintain. According to the report, records show repair costs exceeding $11,000 in 2024 and $12,000 so far in 2025, with over 70 days of downtime. Parts are difficult to source, and some of the truck's safety systems no longer meet current standards for seatbelts, lighting, and ladder mechanisms. Armstrong warned that deferring replacement could ultimately cost taxpayers more money for the unit itself and a much longer delivery wait time. In fact, the report estimates a total savings of about $926,000 if the town proceeds with the purchase this year. If approved, the municipality could make a down payment of $619,519 in 2025 and finance the remaining balance over a 10-year period. The current aerial ladder, purchased in 2003, is expected to have a trade-in value of $100,000 to $150,000. The fire chief explained that similar aerial trucks now cost $2.7 to $3 million with 3 to 4 year wait times, whereas this purchase saves about $700,000 and ensures delivery by January 2026. Refurbishment of the old ladder truck was explored, Chief Administrative Officer Matthew Grant noted, but it would not meet insurance or certification standards, meaning it would not count toward Napanee's superior fire protection rating, a factor that can influence insurance premiums and fire response capacity. Council widely agreed that the 22-year-old ladder truck is well past its useful life. The motion to approve the $2.085 million single-source purchase passed unanimously. The new truck is expected to arrive in January, increasing fire response capabilities across Greater Napanee.
And thank you to Michelle Dory Forsdell for that story. Now over to the LJR reporter for CJAI-FM Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, with a report discussing the potential use of strong mayor powers to address housing shortages in Loyalist Township.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca.
Earlier this year, Loyalist Township was named one of 169 Ontario municipalities to receive strong mayor powers. Ontario's Ministry of Municipal Affairs and Housing made a presentation to Loyalist Township Council this week with a focus on how these powers can help the province reach its goal of increasing housing supply. Deputy Mayor Nathan Townend voiced his concerns about the focus of the presentation.
I never think it's appropriate to score political points by asking pointed questions to public servants. But I will just note that consistently in the last several years, housing starts are down in Ontario. So the evidence that these strong mayor powers are advancing that goal of increasing housing supply is certainly suspect. And this is fairly complex. But one simple thing municipalities have said consistently that will help build more housing is to fund municipal infrastructure to support that housing.
The province originally introduced strong mayor powers in 2022 for the cities of Ottawa and Toronto. Through 2023, 44 additional municipalities received these powers. And as of May 1st this year, 216 of Ontario's 414 single and lower tier municipalities now have this legislation. The presentation was part of a series of outreach sessions the province is doing doing for municipalities who are new to the Strong Mayor powers. It included an overview of what Strong Mayor powers are, as well as references to other municipalities and how they're implementing the powers. Mayor Jim Hagedorn spoke about the work of staff as they move forward on the matter.
Still, as we're proceeding through this, the new Strong Mayor power, I keep coming up with more questions. And fortunately, so far, staff have always been able to do some research and we've been able to work to figure them out. But it'll take a little while before all the municipalities, I'm sure, come to full terms with what it is.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFW and Coburg, Dan Jones, with a story about a significant funding boost for hospice care in Northumberland County.
As county mayors examine where to put a warming hub for homeless people this winter, a staff report lays out several options with two outside of Coburg. The report presented and debated Wednesday by the mayor states that the paramedic facility on William Street in Coburg, the Ontario Agri-Food Venture Center in Colburn, and the Fenella Hall are potential possibilities. The two rural options would require daily transportation services. Integrated Homelessness and Addiction Response Center Director Jordan Stevenson presented to County Council Wednesday, saying none of the options will address the real problem of addictions and homelessness. He says busing people out of Coburg could present challenges in the event of a medical emergency or physical altercation or potentially people using substances.
It's a scary component. What happens if there's a crisis on the way? Are they, again, like I mentioned, are they going to be kicked off the bus? If there's a violent incident, or we get into things like transporting narcotics.
Michelle Day, who lives in Fenella, presented second. Her concerns are that Fenella is too small of a community, adding it has few stores. She predicts the police response to an emergency will be slowed due to Fenella's distance from Coburg.
There's a few stores up here. There's a lot of seniors that live around the Fenella Hall, and it's not going to be good. To get the police or the OPP to come for any situation, it takes a long time. So there's going to be a lot of things that's going to happen. Very little stores, one store really that you can get major groceries. There's going to be a lot of robbery, a lot of theft.
The county spends approximately $8 million a year on homelessness programs, much of that subsidized. The warming room at 310 Division Street in Coburg closed July 4th with the remodeling of services at the shelter. The county put out an expression of interest for a warming hub, stipulating that if it were in Coburg, it would be located on county property. While Coburg residents and businesses have expressed frustration with the situation of the shelter in the downtown core, stigmatization of homelessness is a concern. Cramie Township Mayor Mandy Martin cautioned that some people who are homeless are struggling to find accommodation but are not addicted. Coburg Mayor Lucas Cleveland countered, saying there are programs already in place to assist people wanting help. Trent Hills Mayor Bob Crate expressed annoyance, questioning how much money is being spent on people who are not ready to improve their lives.
We seem to be spending an inordinate amount of time and money for very few people that really don't want our help. And I'm getting to the point where I would like to help those that would like help and provide whatever services they need, but I'm getting frustrated by the fact that we're here dealing with, I don't know, is it five people that would be involved in this situation? And
Crate added, there comes a time in life when people need to take responsibility for themselves. Council did go into closed session to discuss the warming room and other confidential matters, but when resumed in open session, voted to defer the warming room report to an emergency meeting. A date has not been set to resume those discussions. Reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
And thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with CFRC's Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
Thank you, Dinah. This is Jesse Bell with your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Thursday, October 23rd, another rainy day here in the city of Kingston. 84% chance of precipitation, feeling closer to 8 degrees, although the daytime high is listed as 11, dropping down to 5 degrees overnight. Friday, October 24th, mix of sun and cloud, another 11-degree day, still going to feel a little colder than average, right around 8 degrees, dropping down to 4 overnight. We're going to have a cool day on Saturday, October 25th for the Queens versus McMaster playoff football game. Daytime high of just 9 degrees, feeling closer to 4 overnight. Sunday, October 26th, another rainy day here in the city of Kingston, 57% chance of precipitation, daytime high of 10, overnight low of 3, and then starting off next week, Monday, October 27th, 11 degrees is your high with a 60% chance of precipitation, dropping down to a chilly 2 degrees overnight.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.
One more look at him. Pitch. High fly ball. Left field. Arozarena. What does it go?
And that was the Fox Sports call coverage of last night's Canadian Heritage moment as George Springer hit a three-run dinger to put the Blue Jays up in the bottom of the seventh. But this is Plugged in My Ears with Adam and Zayden today. Zayden, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm high on life, man. A Toronto team won something in Game 7. How could I not be excited?
I know. Today we're going to move away from hockey for a little bit. We'll talk a little bit about hockey at the end of it. But we got to talk about this Blue Jays team and this Blue Jays game. So for everyone that, I mean, we don't really cover baseball too much on the show, but for everyone that was unaware, if you are unaware, I don't know how, but the Toronto Blue Jays are going to the World Series for the first time since 1993. So it's been a minute for the Blue Jays, and this team has played well all year. They were the number one team in the American League, won the division. They beat the Yankees in the ALDS, and then they just beat the Mariners in the ALCS. But wow, what a team, what a game. And this was a matchup, Seattle and Toronto, that I honestly would have loved to see both teams win if it was possible. Because Seattle has never been to the World Series since they came into the league in 1977. And that's heartbreaking. I feel for the fans. Obviously, deep down, I really needed the Jays to go to the World Series. But the Mariners, I feel for you. I feel for the fans. It's a drought that reminds me a lot of the Toronto Maple Leafs. Just like not being able to get things done since the 60s, 70s. But I mean, Zayden, I think you want to maybe make a little comment on the Mariners. But what did you think about Seattle and their season and the effort that they put up in the ALCS?
I think the best way to summarize it, I don't know if it's been confirmed which player it was, but I think it was the pitcher, Wu, who was doing an interview, and in the background you just hear a player basically screaming in agony about the loss. Mm-hmm. This team truly did buy in, and they gave it their absolute all. Yeah. There's a reason why the game was as close as it was, and how it would go to seven games in the series. I think for Seattle, they played remarkably. They played with heart, as did the Blue Jays. And ultimately, I chalk this game up to final standings in the season. The Jays had the home advantage, and that's what won them the series.
Yeah, no, completely agree. And they are the first team ever to win Game 7 of a series after losing the first two at home. And I mean, if you had made that comment that home field advantage played a role, like maybe four games into this series, I would have been like, what do you mean? They lost the first two games. Like, they lost home field advantage. But I think that goes to show the strength of this team to overcome losing two games at home, being able to win two games on the road, and then two more at home. I do think that the home crowd carried this team over the last two games. And I think it was just situational. The first two games really were blowouts for the Mariners. And I mean, it's, you got to keep a crowd engaged. And if that's not happening, your team's not going to perform as well. So I think going into the World Series, their challenger, the Los Angeles Dodgers, this is their hardest matchup that they've had all season. They played the Dodgers earlier in the regular season and won the three-game series, winning 2-1. But, I mean, regular season baseball isn't anything compared to the World Series. This is the defending World Series champion that we're seeing. So, Zeta, knowing all that, what do you think the final, like, result of this series is going to be? Do you think the Jays are going to be able to win this one? Do you think the Dodgers will repeat, in how many games?
The Jays are taking this. It doesn't matter how long the series is. Same thing like we saw with Seattle. It does not matter how you start a series. It matters how you finish it. If you finish a series and you're playing lights out, chances are you're going to win that game. And if you continue that for every single one of your quote-unquote final games, hate to break it to you, Adam, you're going to win the series.
Yeah.
And if that's what it takes against the Dodgers, it takes another seven games. I think the Jays are going to always show up when their back is against the wall because they have that drive. They've all bought in. This is a team that, look at them a year ago. Who in 2024 would have been betting saying the Jays are going to win the series next year?
No one.
Yeah. Most fans you talk to, if I went into a Jays bar and said, hey, the Jays are winning the series next year, shut up, man. They're rebuilding.
Yeah.
You get dismissed. And I think when you have such a fun, contagious energy like that, and a team that knows how to perform beyond their one-star batter, that's how you make a team.
Yeah. No, and this team is made up of misfits, I think, honestly. Like last year, they lose 88 games. I mean, a team that loses 88 games isn't even touching the playoffs. So them to even be competitive this year was such a surprise to so many Blue Jays fans. And they've gotten the most impact from players that weren't on the roster last year. I think of Trey Yesavage, who just had an insane outing as the starting pitcher in Game 6. He started the season in single A this year. Like, he was playing three leagues down from the major leagues with Vancouver. And now he is one of their best pitchers, part of their playoff rotation. That's unheard of. You look at star defenders like Andrés Giménez. The guy had seven home runs all regular season, hit two clutch home runs in back-to-back games of game 3 and 4 in Seattle, pretty much saving the season. I mean, it's like, it's the guys that you don't expect to show up always seem to show up for this team. And that's not the case with every team, but I think this team is so special with just, like, as you said, the culture that they have, the way that they handle themselves after losing. One thing that I am concerned about is coming back within a game that seems out of hand. So this last game 7, it was 3-1 in the 7th. That's a tough thing to come back from, and they showed that they can do it. I'm not worried about the short leads, but there's been games that we saw, game 1 and 2 with the Mariners, where they go down 7-1, 5-1, like, and they almost seem like they've given up, and they have given up in some of those games where the bats don't get going. Do you think that's an issue with such a, like, high-powered offense like the Dodgers?
100%. You're going to have a team that's going to come out swinging, and the Jays need to get used to, they might not be the ones to make the first move. Mm-hmm. I think Game 7 was the perfect test to show that when they have to go and step up and make it happen, they'll do it.
Yeah.
We see that you have that senior leadership that knows how to lead by example. They can say, guys, look, we've done it before. Can we not do this again? And the Dodgers will have those huge leads. I'm calling it right now. They might open the scoring with a grand slam for all I know. And I know that's a big claim to make, but that's the type of opening that you're expecting going against is this heavy hitting team.
Yeah. No, it's definitely their hardest opponent, their hardest matchup. So difficult to game plan for because they are so deep. They are such a deep baseball team. We did see them struggle a little bit in the regular season towards the tail end, but they seem to have turned that around. I mean, they just had one of the best single player performances in baseball history with Shohei Ohtani striking out 10 batters as a pitcher and then hitting 3 home runs as a hitter himself. I mean, that is GOAT material
that
right there.
Something else. He is something else.
Yeah. No, he is going to be the guy of this series for the Dodgers, and the Jays have to find out how they're going to minimize his impact. Because
their depth.
It's going to come down to their depth, because they seem to have a good thing going with the guys that they have. Isaiah Kiner-Falefa kind of moved into that lineup playing second base. You see guys like Davis Schneider not getting as much playing time. Miles Straw comes in every once in a while. So the Jays are deep if they have to be. But the last few games, they've been able to go with the same lineup and see tremendous success. So I think it's going to be a lot of the same to start. I think they're going to start off with the same lineup. But I wouldn't be surprised if we see Davis Schneider get in a couple times. But the way that Barger and the outfield's been hitting, Lucas, they both look fantastic. So I can't really see too much of Schneider's impact unless necessary. But the pitching was, last night was an incredible representation of how selfless two starting pitchers for the Blue Jays are, Kevin Gausman and Chris Bassett. Both of them came out of the bullpen. They're not usually bullpen guys. Usually they're used to Gausman being the ace, Bassett being a longtime starter. They come out, they pitch their game. It's only an inning this time, but they were used in some of the most important areas of the game yesterday, and that's just not something that you always see out of starting pitchers. Some of them are like a little... think they're a little shy away. They shy away from it because they're used to pitching 5 or 6 innings. They're not a bullpen guy. They're a starter, right? So it was good to see the selflessness and the veteran mindset of those players. But Zayden, who was your MVP of the series? I mean, there's so many to choose from. You got Vlad, you got Ernie Clement, you got George Springer. I mean, you could even go with the Treya Savage if you want pitching, Shane Bieber. I mean, there's so many to choose from.
I'm a huge Vladdy fan, man.
You gotta be. I mean, the guy's batting like 4.342 or something like that in the
He's not missing it. He's a threat every time he steps up to the plate. And more than that, it's not like he just shows up and goes home. He's a pivotal part to the team. If you go and tell me that he's not impacting the team in a positive way, if his vibes are not uplifting everyone, I wouldn't believe you, because I see him having more of an impact on the team than just when he's at bat, just when he's at first base. It's a full rounded impact, and that's what I call the most valuable player. I don't half the time you can look at your most valuable player. I know we talk about hockey a lot on this show, and that could be saying, oh, like McDavid is all this. Mm-hmm. The question is, if we remove one player out of this equation and McDavid loses all of his oomph, who's the MVP? Is it McDavid or is it the player that can make that happen? And Vladdy makes that entire package come true.
Yeah, it's almost just like an added addition that he's really good at baseball. Like, yes, he's a
That's the bonus.
That is the bonus. He's a great locker room guy. I know the home run jacket was his idea, and it's cool to see them having a postseason version of that. And I mean, it's getting passed around a lot right now. We see them hit a lot of home runs, something we didn't really see too much of in the regular season, or as much as we were kind of used to with the Blue Jays. But there are a few question marks going into the World Series. So Bo Bichette has not played in the playoffs at all, and that's because of an injury he's coming off. There were some rumors that he might come on to the World Series roster and the ALCS roster when they were making it as either a designated hitter or a pinch hitter, because apparently he can hit, but he just isn't there motion wise for fielding. Would you want to insert a cold batter like Bo Bichette in? I mean, he brings so much skill. And if he were to come in as a designated hitter or a pinch hitter, he might provide some use, but I don't know. What do you think, Zayden? He sat out like the last 3 weeks of the regular season and the entire playoffs. Would you put him on your roster?
There's such a debate there. Do you wait early in this? Do you want to wait to the end? You want to do it early in the series while you have time if it doesn't work?
Yeah.
Right now, you can only prepare, and that means throwing anything at the wall to see what sticks.
Yeah.
What I'm more interested in is his own mindset, and we can't see the way he's playing. We don't know where he's at recovery-wise. every player wants to be out there. It's the World Series. Everyone's going to go, like, we know they're athletes. They could be working through something and they're going to say, I want to be out there. Mm-hmm. That's what I dreamed of. They want to be part of it. So I wouldn't be surprised if he pushes everything aside to get out there. I think there could be a positive impact because that is veteran. That is someone with amazing sort of knowledge and ability.
Yeah.
The downside is, are they at risk? And it's more of a question when you put him in. And if they're able to make that work, I think it's a no-brainer. I do think it's a no-brainer. Get him in there. See what he can do. Because and I want to emphasize in front of a home crowd.
Yeah.
Away, that nothing's going to happen. You do that in a home crowd, everyone's rocking. This guy feels it, and boom, there you go. That's your momentum.
No, I absolutely agree with you. I think you've got to put him on the roster, and he's got to come in only if you need him. I only think you need to play Bichette if there is someone in the lineup that is clearly not hitting the ball well and that you need a pinch hitter, because that's a lot of pressure to put on him too. Like, oh, okay, you're coming back from your injury. Nice. Take your time. Bam. Seventh inning of the game four of the World Series. Go in and bat for us. You know, that's a lot to expect out of a guy that hasn't really played in a while. We saw something similar with Seattle. So Brian Wu, who you had mentioned earlier, was on the injured list and hadn't pitched since September, coming into the, like, early September, coming in. This was his first or second appearance. I think he played in the Seattle game, in the one in Seattle. I think he played in that game. But he looked shaky too. And he's usually a guy that, like, he's a starting pitcher, usually one of the better starting pitchers on the Mariners. He came out of the bullpen and he couldn't hit the strike zone. And that really honestly killed this team, because that put men on, and then obviously Springer took care of the rest. But I think that that's an example of someone that wasn't really necessary for him to come back. He's good to have on the roster, but almost like too pressure-filled of a situation for a guy coming back from injury. And I think that that's something that the Jays want to avoid with Bichette.
You got the weight of the world on your shoulder. Think about some of the craziest emails, phone calls, texts, conversations that you're having.
Yeah.
Put that all into one, and now you're being thrown into it, having to perform mentally and physically. That's one of the biggest demands you can ask of someone.
Absolutely. Now, there's one player on the Mariners that I do want to highlight for just the amazing series that they had, and that's Josh Naylor, the Canadian kid from Mississauga. He had a great series. He was the only one that seemed to not be fazed by any of the pitchers that the Jays were throwing. He's one of the most consistent batters on the team, was batting .340 in the series, which is just phenomenal, especially on a series where their heavy hitters, Julio Rodriguez, Kyle Raleigh, really didn't do as much. Obviously, they both hit home runs yesterday, but the rest of the series, they were kind of minimized by the Jays' pitching. But this Naylor, I mean, I was surprised to see him play so well. Not that I didn't think he was a good player, but just because he's not the guy and a guy that I would expect to excel when they have such stars already on the team. But he's a free agent at the end of the year, and he's going to get paid, because this experience, this performance has been insane to see out of Naylor. But a lot of people are thinking, oh, Blue Jays should go after this guy. But I'm like, oh, they already got a pretty good first baseman. I don't know if we need another one. But it was good to give him some props, because, I mean, he showed out for his team. Would be a great addition to any team that picks him up. But going into the World Series, I think that the Jays are going to have to heavily rely on the same thing that they've been relying on the whole playoffs, and that's hits. Just getting hits. Ernie Clement, one of my favorite players on the Blue Jays, swings on the first pitch almost every time, and he gets a lot of singles. Doesn't get those big plays, doesn't get too many doubles, too many home runs, but that gets the consistent hits, and I think that that's what we're going to see out of a lot of the guys. Obviously, power plays a good role. I don't mind a little power. Last night, we saw some power, but it's the hits, the consistent runs. Make the Dodgers pitchers work. I mean, I feel like yesterday there were so many innings where the Jays put up donut holes that I was like, man, the bats have not been going. I think they had four or five hits going into the seventh inning, and that's just not a game-winning formula. So I was really happy to see them turn it around. But yeah, I think that kind of wraps up our ALCS chat. Zayden, anything else you want to add? Any other comments? Any other emotions watching that game?
I always like to look at it from both sides of the coin. If we didn't win that game, what would the storyline be? And the storyline is exactly what you just mentioned, Adam. Jays fail to get on base. Jays fail to get home. Where they're doing everything right on in the outfield. They're keeping the score low, but they just couldn't get it done on those short runs. They were able to pull through, and that's not the narrative that we go with now. Now we see they pull through narrowly. And I want to emphasize that narrow aspect because Seattle, they had it in their grasp. And that's what makes it more cruel. That's as close to an overtime loss without it being an overtime loss.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, I completely agree. We're looking forward to this. I'm happy we're recording this on the Tuesday after the game and we didn't record this yesterday while the game was happening because we wouldn't have anything to talk about.
Always have stuff to talk about.
We always have stuff to talk about. Just wouldn't it be as exciting as this. But moving over to the NHL... We've had the first couple games, first week or two of the season have gone down. And so far, I mean, just for everyone that doesn't know, Zayden's big Leafs guy. I'm a big Habs guy. Both teams are doing pretty well. It's a good start to the season. I mean, we've mentioned this before to each other, and I think maybe even on the show. Life's better when both the Habs and Leafs are good at the same time.
I agree with that.
It's nice to see. I mean, obviously, I wish the first game turned out a little bit different, as the Leafs are one of Montreal's two losses this year. But, I mean, I'm happy with the Habs season. Zayden, what are you thinking about the Leafs? How are you liking their start?
Oh, man. I'm not a believer yet. And that's coming from someone who's always... I'm beyond bought in. I like watching good hockey. And I understand there's a time for playoff hockey. There's a time for regular season hockey. And I don't think the Leafs have figured that out yet. I know they're trying to play with a nice blend. The Berube style is very much a blend of playoff with a little bit of regular during the regular season and then going strictly playoff. That way it's not a shock.
Right.
It's them knowing how to play. But the difference they need to properly understand is when you go into playoffs, you're playing against other teams that are playing playoff hockey. You're not playing teams that are playing regular season hockey. So let your superstars go and get hot. Let these players really have a chance to step up, because I've been missing that a little bit. The Leafs are the heaviest team in the league.
Yep.
And I don't think I look at the Leafs and go, man, they're ferocious. No, I really have a problem with it because they need to go and show that grit. Yes, when Stolarz was bodied the net, the ref already had his hand up. I don't care. That's your goalie. Send a message. I think the Leafs have looked soft, if anything. And yes, they're already known for that, and that makes it a little bit harder to change people's minds. But I want to see more. I want to see that grit. I want to see that them throwing the body a little bit more after every check. That way teams know, back off, don't even try it.
Yeah.
Because right now, all that we see is the other top teams in the league are not to... You're not going to go and mess around with them because they'll mess you up.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I mean, we see that from a lot of the good teams in the past, that they always seem to have either one or two guys that are willing to stand up for all of the players on the team, especially the goalie. Now, the only Leafs game that I watched was the first game because, obviously, Montreal was playing Toronto. Toronto won that game, but Montreal heavily outplayed the Leafs in that game. I don't know if you were able to tune in, but Montreal dominated in the shots, dominated offensive possession time. Stolarz played incredible.
He's been incredible.
Yeah, he's been insane. Like, honestly, one of the best goaltending performances I've seen out of a Maple Leaf, like, collectively, his last few games. But the Leafs just looked a little different without Mitch Marner on the ice.
It's an adjustment. Yeah. I get that. But the biggest thing that we're seeing right now is a team be tested. Mm-hmm. Most recent thing to come out of that Leafs locker room has been Stolarz.
Yep.
Shaking things up after an overtime loss to, of course, Seattle. Because Toronto and Seattle are just going at it right now.
Yeah.
And what we saw was Stolarz directly calling out William Nylander to the media without saying his name. I thought what Stolarz said was very classy. He said what everyone was thinking, and he was frustrated. He's standing on his head. He's been standing on his head. I think he understands. He signed his extension. He took a discount. Why? He could have gotten paid somewhere else, but he wants to win.
Yeah.
He doesn't want to win as the backup. He wants to win as the starter because he made it happen.
Yeah. No, and that's what he's doing. He's willing his way into being one of the top goalies in the league right now. And he's doing it on a team that's not giving him too much help on defense.
Not at all. Lazy back check. And you can't, it's been criticism after criticism year after year. Mm-hmm. And I know Leafs fans are great at criticizing without providing any sort of solution.
Right.
You have your solution right there. You have someone calling you out, making sure that it is public, that even for a likable guy like Nylander, everyone needs to buy in. I don't care who you are. And if they do that, if they go and look at this Jays run and can capture that energy, that's how you take it into their match tonight and actually use it.
Yeah, no, you're talking about, you showed me beforehand about the Morgan Riley interview too, and how he's like essentially saying, yeah, you just have to buy in. Like,
yeah, he's jealous. He said he's jealous of the Jays right now. He's envious because he wants that to be them. They want to go on the deep run because they feel they can do it.
Yeah, and I mean,
prove it.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you look at the recent history of Toronto sports, Jays locked in this year. The Raptors locked in a couple years ago, won a championship. Toronto FC's locked in a couple times, went all the way to the MLS Cup, won the MLS Cup. I think it's Leafs' turn, maybe? I don't know. Is this the year?
There's so many things about this Leafs organization that would have to make it their year.
And you know what? I think it would be their year if it wasn't for the Montreal Canadiens, because boy, is this team on
fire.
I
thought you were going to say the Suits.
Oh, okay. That's a good point, too. That might play a role. But I've loved watching the Montreal Canadiens this year.
Yeah, the crowd is loud. They're actively involved. It's not like you're walking. Like, I think some people walk into Scotiabank Arena and they're like, oh, geez, I thought this was Ripley's Aquarium. Like, I see the glass. I see things on the other side. No one's really talking.
Yeah.
Like, well, tell me the difference between Ripley's and Scotiabank Arena. At the very top, you have a lot of excitement. People think that's just the ambient noise. Oh, is that coming from a speaker? Yeah. Good thing I don't have to make noise. Meanwhile, everyone down there, they're enjoying their sushi probably from Ripley's. Like, geez.
No, I mean, I the Montreal game where Hudson blocked the empty net shot and then sprung Caulfield, the Habs fans were on their feet already. Like, it was the last few seconds of the game. They were ready to, like, explode. And then I just think the crowd can carry a team. It can fuel a team. I think it really is. I know the Seattle Seahawks, they've got, like, the 12th man. That's what they call their crowd. And I used to think that was kind of ridiculous. I'm like, yeah, right, whatever. A team can't do that. Team can't really have a 12th guy. But you know what? I'm convinced. After going to a Montreal game and then watching them slowly rebuild and gain the confidence of the crowd and themselves. I mean, it's amazing what a good fan base. Like, not even what a good fan base, because Toronto's got a great fan base. It's
not at the games.
They have
one of the biggest.
At the games.
The Leafs fans are more fun at an away game than they are at a home game. Because you name a game or another team that can actually make this happen, we see the Leafs go and play away in Detroit, and do you know what you hear? You hear, go Leafs, go, and then a response from their team.
Yeah.
When I was in Seattle, oh my goodness, of course it's Seattle. Watching the Leafs play the Kraken last year.
Yeah.
It was so much fun going back and forth with the, funny enough, home team crowd.
Yeah.
And that makes a difference. I think the Leafs might feel more comfortable on the road sometimes, because at home they might have all this, but it's like same old. It's not like you're going to entertain for someone that's finally getting to a game. It's you need that energy.
No, I know what you mean. And the Leafs have, despite all these slow starts, I mean, they're still 3-2-1. They've got a good start to the season. 7 points through six games. Third in the Atlantic. Not too bad. It seems like the teams that we thought were going to be good this year are not doing so well.
What do you mean?
Tampa Bay, 4 points. Florida, 6 points. Obviously, Florida's pretty beat up, banged up, but Tampa, 4 points. Ottawa, 4 points. Like, some of these teams made the playoffs last year. Like, I'm kind of stunned at some of them.
I mean, the most shocking one to me is the Rangers.
Yeah.
They've yet to score a point at home.
They're somehow still there, 7 points. They're creeping their way up. I think the Rangers are dangerous once they figure this out. I watched them play against Montreal.
They're good.
They're a good team. Like, this is
Shesterkin.
Yeah.
Same case as Stolarz. I think the players, I think we see a lot of this talk about the actual atmosphere in the hockey atmosphere. Our goalies getting worse. Our players getting better. Mm-hmm. I think it's a matter of playing a complete game, and especially for these goalies that are ready and willing to step up and show that they can flash leather.
Absolutely.
How do you follow that up as a team? How do you go and use the energy that you're creating to go and get your team across the finish line?
Yeah, no, couldn't have said it better myself. Over in the West, we got two teams I want to focus on. I want to focus on the Vegas Golden Knights with their new star, Mitch Marner. They are looking very nice. Vegas is leading the division. No regulation losses so far. But I think this was pretty expected. Yeah. I think we knew Vegas was going to be good. They also signed the controversial Carter Hart. So we will see how that turns out.
Are you surprised?
No, not surprised. If it was going to be any team, it'd be Vegas. So the other team I want to focus on is the Edmonton Oilers. They're struggling. 2-3-1 to start the year. 5 points. Bottom of the conference. But, I mean, this seems to be a trend for the Oilers.
I was going
to
say, are you stressed? I'm not stressed. The least I'm stressed out about. The Oilers, I'm not losing any sleep over them.
2 years ago, when the Oilers won like 20 games in a row and were able to make the playoffs, I was like, yeah, okay, whatever. It seems like they don't even need to try in October. But yeah, so I think those are probably the most significant slow starts. I mean, LA is kind of having a slower start too. Chicago's having a good start. They're up into the playoffs, which is nice to see. I don't know if they'll be able to sustain that just because of how young they are. But I mean, it's good to see kind of some shifts. I feel like the last few years, it's been the good teams are the good teams, bad teams are the bad teams. Now we're kind of seeing rebuilds are kind of graduating. They're kind of building their way up. So I think that we're going to have to talk about that next week. Hopefully we have some similar trends in the standings, but Zayden, I really appreciate you coming on the show last minute and giving your